Welcome to As It Is, a 30-minute program designed for English learners. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Christopher Jones Cruz, Dorothy Gundy, John Russell, and Dan Friedel. Later, Anne Ball will have this week's Science in the News report. But first, here is Christopher Jones Cruz.
The United States is working to reach its goal of bringing 10,000 Syrian refugees to the country by the end of September. There has been an increase in the number of Syrian refugees entering the U.S. in the past 3 months. More than 8,000 people who fled violence and persecution in Syria have been resettled in the United States between October 1, 2015, and this week. The State Department's Refugee Processing Center says half are under the age of 14. A few hundred Syrian refugees have entered the U.S. every month since last September. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry announced a plan to welcome them. Experts had said it would be difficult to reach the goal of bringing 10,000 Syrian refugees to the U.S. by the end of September. The previous year, 1,682 Syrian refugees entered the country. But in February, the State Department created a center in Amman, Jordan, to help refugees apply to enter the U.S. The application, interviews, and medical and security investigations necessary before refugees can be accepted usually take 18 to 24 months. But American officials said having the new center would reduce that time to 3 months. In May, 1,069 Syrian refugees entered the United States. More than 2,000 entered in both June and July. The 8,000 Syrian refugees who have entered so far have been sent to 38 states. Michigan has the most, 887. California received 783. Arizona, 651. Texas, 565. And Pennsylvania, 481. More refugees have been resettled in the United States than any other country. Almost 61,000 refugees have entered the U.S. since last October. Last year, Kerry also announced that the government would increase the number of refugees permitted into the U.S. from 70,000 to 85,000. The number is set by the president after he or she receives advice from the State Department. It will increase to 100,000 in the coming year. But many more Syrians want to enter the United States. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees estimates 4.8 million Syrians have fled to Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, and Iraq. The office says 6.6 million have been displaced within Syria. The Syrian civil war began in 2011. At that time, the U.S. was accepting only a few Syrian refugees every year. millions of Syrians fleeing conflict, and Islamic State violence across the country, have been accepted by Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey. Many Republican governors have criticized the Obama administration's decision to accept more Syrian refugees. Several state legislatures have considered bills to slow or stop the resettlement of some or all refugees in their states. Some opponents of the refugee resettlement plan say they do not believe the security investigations of the refugees have been complete enough. The administration has said they are. In early July, an Associated Press GFK public opinion survey found that 69% of Republicans support a temporary ban on Muslim immigration. 52% of Americans opposed such a ban. 45% supported it. In September, the UN General Assembly will meet to discuss refugee and migrant issues. Almost 1 million Syrians are seeking asylum in Europe. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
A new company has been created to research and develop medical treatments using bioelectronics. Bioelectronic treatments use a small device placed inside the body to change electronic nerve signals to treat and possibly cure diseases. The British pharmaceutical company GlaxoSmithKline, or GSK, and Google's Verily Life Sciences formed the new company, Galvani Bioelectronics. They expect to invest about $715 million into the business during the next 7 years. GSK will own 55% of the company and Verily 45%. GSK has spent the last 3 years creating a special map of nerves. It shows how the nerves affect organs and the disease process. Verily is expert at small device design and engineering. Monsef Slaoui is chairman of vaccines at GSK. He says Galvani Bioelectronics will build on the strengths and technologies of the two companies. GSK says these small bioelectronics devices could potentially treat diseases including diabetes, arthritis, and asthma. The device could be used to guide insulin out of cells to treat diabetes, for example, or to correct muscle differences in lung disease. Chris Pham is president of Galvani. He told Reuters news agency that the company had good results using the device in animal testing. He said the first generation of devices would be about the size of a small pill. But, he said, one day it will be smaller than a grain of rice. Pham said Galvani expects the first devices to be ready for government inspection by 2023. A major difficulty for researchers is to make the device work on extremely low power so it can be used deep inside the body. At first, Galvani will employ about 30 scientists, engineers, and other lab workers. It will be based at GSK's research center north of the British capital, London. A second research lab will set up in San Francisco, California. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
While recovering from a football injury, an American college student named John Cefalu decided to use his free time to develop a plan. He wanted to create a nonprofit organization. Now in its third year, his organization operates 12 offices in Africa. The program, called Health to Humanity, trains people to develop, use, and sell sanitary products. The goal is to not only improve sanitation services and fight disease, but create jobs and economic growth, too. To finance Health to Humanity, Cefalu and his team sell soap made in the United States to Americans. Half of the money goes to his business, and half goes toward funding Health to Humanity. Individual donations also support the nonprofit organization. Health to Humanity identifies people who agree with its goals and would support its programs in Africa. The organization trains candidates to start up a business. It teaches these men and women to make soap and other sanitary products, and then gives them a short-term subsidy. The money from the subsidy buys raw, unprocessed materials and helps these entrepreneurs launch their business. On average, establishing a soap-making micro-business that will last 10 to 20 years costs $10,000, said Cefalu. The hope is to help entrepreneurs make and sell products to sustain themselves and their communities. Hezron Nijiri grew up in central Kenya. He dreamed of directing a business or a hotel. He never imagined an American college student would help make his dream possible. Nijiri told VOA, "When Health to Humanity came to Kenya, I noticed that this is my opportunity now to become a manager that I've been dreaming to be, and also to work with the community, to work with the children, and also encouraging them and giving hope about life and their future." Children are important to Nijiri because he grew up without his parents in an orphanage. He started his own business, making and selling soap. He was so successful that Health to Humanity asked him to lead its implementation program. Now, Nijiri helps other people to become entrepreneurs. Cefalu said Health to Humanity is different from many nonprofit organizations that work in Africa. It is different, he said, because it is not just a charitable group. Cefalu says that his nonprofit's goal is to make sure that people are able to develop themselves. Corey Moss, Health to Humanity's marketing director, said most charity work does not do this. She added that charitable work has created an environment in Africa where people do not believe in themselves. Cefalu added that most of the entrepreneurs helped by Health to Humanity have never had any work experience. Many of them lack education and live in places that offer no possibility of employment. We found that the people we're training, they're looked up to because they're not looking out for just themselves, Cefalu noted. They want to bring the community under their wing and create awareness and make their lives better. He added that the entrepreneurs get more than financial security. They also develop a sense of satisfaction and a desire to help others. Cefalu says the program has helped people. It has created jobs, decreased illness rates, and improved awareness of hygiene products. And there are other benefits. We are seeing just overall self-value and self-worth, something about holding onto your own business and having your own opportunity and providing for yourself, he added. Cefalu hopes to expand Health to Humanity to Asian and Latin American countries. I'm John Russell.
There is a saying that advises, when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. In other words, make the best out of a bad situation. Some people in the Netherlands are taking that advice. This June, they suffered under one of the rainiest months in Europe in more than 100 years. But instead of complaining about the rain, some Amsterdam residents decided to take advantage of the extra water. No, not to make lemonade, to make beer. Joris Hobe is an entrepreneur in the Netherlands. He was already working on projects to help Amsterdam be more like a sponge. The projects aimed to help the city capture and use more rainwater before it goes into the sewer system and out to sea. Hobe also enjoys making beer at home. He thought he might be able to capture rainwater and use it to make beer.
Well, I thought I need water to make beer. And we have this problem of these heavy rainfalls, so why don't we combine these two?
When Hobe makes beer, he does not need too much water. But larger beer makers do need a lot of water. It takes about 5 liters of water to make 1 liter of beer. Because water is a significant expense for a brewery, anything the small brewery can do to limit that cost is helpful. So Hobe thought he might be able to talk a small brewery into using rainwater to make beer. Workers at Brewery De Pryl in Amsterdam were not sure about the idea at first. One concern was that the rainwater would be dirty. But Hobe and a partner, Pavel van Dutekom, were already working on a rain-catching system that filters the water so it is safe to drink. The two men were assisted by a group of students at the Amsterdam University of Applied Sciences. When Hobe and the students said they could provide 1,000 liters of water, the brewery workers thought it would be worth a try. Thomas Gessink is the marketing manager of Brewery De Pryl. Gessink said he never thought of using rainwater to make beer. He thinks the brewery is the first in Amsterdam to experiment with rain as a water source.
Because it's the first time it has ever been done by my knowledge, and it's a very innovative project.
The team boiled the water and filtered it to make sure it was clean. They then started making a blonde beer called Hemel's Water, which means heavenly water in Dutch. It is almost sold out. Hobe told the Guardian newspaper that making beer is only the beginning. The plan is to put more water collection tanks and filters around Amsterdam. If the showers continue, residents can capture the rain and use it to make anything that needs water. Soup, sorbet, and yes, even lemonade. I'm Dan Friedel.
On Earth, American astronaut Kate Rubens researched some of the deadliest diseases, like Ebola. Now, while orbiting the planet in the International Space Station, she will be testing a new device that analyzes genetic material. Her job is to use a new kind of DNA sequencing machine and find out if it can be used in space. DNA is short for deoxyribonucleic acid. It is made of chains of molecules that carry the instructions for the development and growth of living things. Genes are made of DNA. The device Rubens is testing is called the Minion DNA Sequencer. It is made by the company Oxford Nanopore Technologies. The sequencer is small, about half the size of a smartphone. It sequences or finds the order of the DNA molecules found in cells. The small device could have a big effect on understanding astronauts' health in space. The tests will show whether the technology can be used later to understand microbes in the space station. It might also help find genetic changes in the astronauts, and it might be able to diagnose illnesses in the future. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration is the U.S. space agency. NASA said the device might even be able to test materials from Mars for signs of DNA-based life in future missions.
And the hatch now opening to the Soyuz MS-01 spacecraft and the arrival of 3 new crew members on the International Space Station. Kate Rubens first through the hatch.
Rubens arrived at the space station in July. She is a trained microbiologist. She is known for her work with dangerous organisms that cause diseases.
So I think people always look at my background and think I'm going to do something crazy science fiction on space station. But we do have a lot of controls up here. Anything that we bring up to the space station has to be checked for safety.
Safety is so important because the space station is a closed loop environment. That means the air and water is recycled. Rubens says NASA scientists came up with an incredibly well thought out set of experiments. The experiments include testing a virus and bacteria that are used in many labs on Earth and are not harmful. One of the first things the astronauts need to find out is how well the DNA sequencer operates in space, where there is almost no gravity.
technology behaves differently up here. Fluids behave differently up here. Bubbles form in fluids. And so it's going to be a really interesting piece of equipment just to check out and to understand.
Sarah Wallace is a microbiologist at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. She calls the MinION sequencer a game changer in space. Until now, samples from space had to be frozen and returned to Earth to be studied. If the device is successful, scientists will be able to see what is happening to human beings and to cells in real time. The machine could be used to help diagnose illnesses in astronauts living on the station. It could also help astronauts understand which drugs would work on disease-causing microbes if someone is sick at the station. This could help limit using valuable medications that cannot be quickly replaced in space. Wallace explains that the MinION sequencer operates differently from other DNA sequencers. Others usually take 24 to 48 hours to run, then stop. But up in space, this sequencer will display its results as it works. Within minutes of loading your sample, Wallace says, you're starting to get the sequence data back. If all goes well, the machine will be able to tell which genes are turning on and off in response to being in space. This is important, Wallace says, because we know that there are changes in spaceflight. But scientists still do not know how and why the astronauts' bodies are changing. We need to know the how and the why, Wallace says. This is important for NASA to know to be able to send people on longer space flights to places like Mars. In the future, astronaut Rubens would like to use the DNA sequencer to learn more about possible microbes that might live in the station's water system and elsewhere on the space station. They have wonderful clean water in the station, Rubens says. But she wonders if microbes could be living in the water system after it has been in place for 15 years. The water on the station comes from recycled urine and condensate, sweat, and exhaled breath. She says there are interesting scientific questions to answer about how people live in space.
We've also got a fantastic research environment to really learn some completely novel things about how human beings behave in a closed-loop environment.
This device joins other instruments on the space station that can be used to discover problems, including one device that can test single genes.
These kinds of small, portable genomic technologies are going to let us look in real time what's actually happening to bone degradation, for example, what's happening to your immune system.
The technology already has been used successfully on Earth. During the recent Ebola outbreak in Africa, it was used for tests in rural and poor areas where it worked quickly and well. I'm Ann Ball.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.